Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he had just celebrated his 21st birthday when he took to the skies as a B-17 tail gunner in the largest aerial assault of World War II. Soon, he was trying to send this desperate message.
Tail gunner crew, I'm hit.
Find out what it took to save his life and how he survived the next 6 months as a prisoner of war. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so the rest of us remember the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot and are often inspired by these stories. The story you're going to hear today is in a book called 11-2. The author is Frank Kravitz of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And you were born here in East Pittsburgh, do I have that right?
Not East Pittsburgh, but East Pittsburgh Post Office, a little community outside the Westing plant.
So we talking a small little borough here. What was it like when you were growing up? What was life like in this area?
Great life. I was born in the Oak Hill section of things. My mother died when I was 3 years old. My dad remarried. He worked for Westinghouse. And my dad and my stepmother moved to a brand new house in the terrace part of East Pittsburgh, where brand new homes shortly after the Depression. And he had worked for Westinghouse and made a few bucks and was able to buy a brand new home. So we didn't live in poverty as far as accommodations were. But the food and the clothing was rather difficult for 7 siblings and a family, mother and dad.
So one of 8 kids, and you lost your mother at that early age, and then the Depression hits. I mean, that seems like a whole lot of things to demoralize you, but I get the sense you weren't demoralized at all.
Well, I was so young that when my dad remarried, I vaguely remember when I was like 3 years old who my mother and father were there. But I didn't find out that my real mother had died for a long time, which I resented for a long time, that they didn't tell me. And I found out in a way that wasn't very pleasant. So I survived that, and with my friendship with my real brothers and my stepbrothers and sisters, you know, I had mixed emotions of who I was and where I was coming from or where I was going. After I went to high school and I finished in midterm in my senior year, and I had enough credits, so I graduated in June, and I applied to the University of Pittsburgh School of Engineering and started my engineering course. Now, this is 1941, okay, in June, uh-huh. World War II, and you know when that started.
Well, and that's one question I ask every single veteran, because everybody seems to have a memory of that day, December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day? Where were you, and how'd you find out?
My second oldest brother was already in the service. He went, goodbye, dear, I'll be back in a year, you know. My oldest brother had a medical difficulty. He was exempt from it. My next brother joined the Marine Corps as soon as he found out Pearl Harbor was bombed. So that's where we were indoctrinated to the war. My brother was home from the service for a weekend pass, and everybody's in at the dinner table. And we heard the words on the radio that Pearl Harbor was bombed, you know. And the word was that anybody that's in the service, come back to your base immediately. So me being younger, I didn't absorb all that at first, you know. It was a lot of crying and everything else. And I said, what's going on, you know.
So then you're going to school here at the University of Pittsburgh. We're sitting right here next to the campus at the VA Medical Center. And when was it that you decided you wanted to get into the Air Corps? Were you wanting to become a pilot, or how did that all come around?
Everyone was being drafted and everything for the service, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and everything else. And I had an affection. I built model airplanes when I was a kid, flew them with the paper and everything else, you know. But I knew I was going to go to the Air Force if I go. So my dad, 2 sons already in the service, he went to the draft board and got an exemption for me because I wasn't old enough, you know. So I ended up getting two exemptions. I asked to go with the second one. They wouldn't let me go, you know. By the second one, I'm old enough to go. So I broke their hearts, I guess, and everything else because they didn't want me to go. But I enlisted in the Air Force, and that's how I entered the service.
And the date that happened was?
11-2.
And there's the title of your book, 11-2. That wasn't the only 11-2, but that November 2nd, 1943, when you enlisted?
Yes.
So you signed up for the Army Air Corps because you wanted to be a pilot, right? You've been flying model airplanes, and your dream was to be a pilot. How far in those dreams did you get?
I got as far as taking the basic training and passing all the tests to be take flight training. And we were told to go to back to our barracks and wait to be assigned. So I think it took us about 10 days. And some guys were getting called. And then once you got in there, when I got called, they said you're going to training school, mechanic school and gunnery school, because there's no more available, you know, positions at the schools. So I was devastated, you know. I had my 1 year of college degree, and I would have been going for another year of credits for a 2 year. And I was devastated, and I said, well, I'll make the most of it. And I was assigned to a crew then. And that's how I got to be tail gunner.
So you become a tail gunner on a B-17, which is a 10-man crew, right?
10-man crew. Yeah.
Did your crew form a pretty good bond with each other? Did you guys spend enough time around each other that you knew each other and had some kind of friendship, relationship?
Well, the relationship that we had, the pilot, the co-pilot, and the bombardier were all married. And the top turret gunner, he was married. The rest of us were all single. Okay, that's how I got on the crew that way. At that time, the wives came to the base wherever we were. We were in Florida, and they stayed with them until we went overseas and that. So the relationships with the couples were different than us single guys. We went our way, they went their way, you know. And that's how we, once we got to England, we were one unit then, you know.
You weren't married yet, but there is a picture in your book of you in uniform with a pretty good-looking teenage girl there. Were you thinking she might be marriage material already before you headed overseas?
Well, there were so many guys getting married, you know. And I says, well, I'll take my shot of it, too, you know. I'll call her up. I says, do you think there's any possibility of your parents letting you marry me before I go overseas, you know? I guess she had a talk with her parents and that, and it's absolutely not, you know. So that was it, you know. So I don't think she ever, we never talked about that afterwards, but it was just, that's the way it was, okay?
Well, it gave you something to come back for, right?
Well, that's the other thing. Now, here I am missing in action from November till April. Yeah. They don't know where I am. Yeah. My parents, her, or anybody don't know, you know, because I'm missing in the woods up in Germany.
Well, we're going to get to that story. Before I hear about your sixth and final mission, was it a thrill for you to get up in the air on your first mission?
Absolutely. I figured I made it then. The awesome, being able to go up in the air, you know, and then learning all about the plane. And we were all friends and everything else, and we were just good camaraderie, that's all.
And as a tail gunner, your job was, can you explain that to us? What all you had to do, what your responsibilities were as a tail gunner, and you're looking backwards out the back of the plane, right?
Well, the thing that the Germans did, they would come in, we knew that their attacks were always on a B-17 from north to east to south. And so we knew which way they're coming. So if you're in the tail, you're looking out to the left. So you're always looking for fighters in the left. They're not going to be on the right, guys, and they're going to come anyway, you know. And some may come from the bottom, but those are going to be, you know, they show you the bottom, and that's it, you know. But the ones that you can feel when you call in, the tail gunner of the crew, enemy planes 3 o'clock high. So they're out for no good, you know, so. And that's the way we did it. So I did, on the mic, tail gunner, 3 o'clock high, 3 o'clock high. So I guess they get it, once they came in, they just came fast, you know.
Did you encounter many fighters on your first five missions?
No. Once somebody said from the crew, they saw some fighters. The reason was that the manufacturing of German planes at that time of the war, you know, were diminishing rapidly, and they weren't replacing them. So it might take them 3 or 4 months to get a crew of planes up to make an attack. But there's nothing wrong with their big guns.
Yeah, and this is late 1944, the fall of 44 we're talking about. Their big guns are what would send the flak your way. So it sounds like you had to fly through some of that flak, huh?
Oh, and that was terrible. It's just black puffs of smoke up there. And the first mission we come back, we didn't get any holes in the plane. But the second or the fourth or something like that, we received holes in the plane.
Some people don't get this, but they think that, you know, if someone's shooting at you, well, then you move out of the way. But when you're flying in formation, you can't do that, right? I mean, and is that a helpless feeling, knowing you're just going to have to fly right through the flak, and if they have the elevation right, you guys are going to be riddled with shrapnel?
You accept it. You know, what kind of evasive action can you take with four squadrons of planes? You know, what kind of evasive action can you take with four squadrons of planes? You know, so you just hope the speed and everything else, you could make your missions, that's all. And a lot of men make 50 missions.
At that point, had you ever dealt with much fear or concern that you might not make it home?
No, I hadn't I didn't develop that yet.
Yeah.
Not yet, I didn't. I was ready to go for the every 6 months mission. You know, you thought you're invincible anyway, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't know. I didn't even know what it was going to be like if I got hit.
Yeah.
You know, I soon learned in a hurry, though.
Well, yeah, so you had enlisted on 11-2, November 2nd, 43, and 11-2-44 is a pretty significant date. Also, walk us through that day from start to finish, because that's probably the most unforgettable day of your life, I imagine.
Well, we took off at 8 o'clock, about 8 o'clock in the morning. By the time we got rendezvous, our poop, and got in position for this bombing stream going to our target, we flew around at different altitudes. You know, we're just going around and around and around, you know. And once we got to 15,000 feet, while we went on oxygen, we were getting close to France or something like that, you know, where the Germans were. And we weren't on oxygen up till then. The anticipation comes when you see the black smoke coming up, if it's flak, you know. And somebody else ahead sees that, so they're telling us, you know, enemy fire up ahead, you know. So you got over 1,000 bombers in the air, a stream going in, you know.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, when our pilots, they opened the bomb bay doors and get ready for attack, and that, you know, we dropped our bombs, and we turned off the target, and shortly after we turned off the target, we were attacked.
When you say attacked, you're not talking about the flak anymore. You're talking about German fighters coming right at you, and you saw them? Did someone else tell you they were coming, or were you the one who saw them?
3 o'clock high,
yeah.
You know, saw them coming.
How many of them?
3 abreast. You know, and I saw the cannon fire coming out of the wings for the last seconds, you know, and I fired back at them when I was still alive, you know.
And you shot one of them down?
I got credit for it. Somebody else in the other crew said that the tail gunner shot down a plane, so that I have the citation for that, you know.
They give you a DFC for that?
No, I didn't get it. I only had 6 missions. That was the thing. And I never pursued. I probably should have had it, but I didn't bother with it.
Well, you had bigger concerns because you shot one of them down, but they were shooting at you. Tell us what happened to you in the tail of that plane.
Okay, when the second wave of planes came in, I was had my target on the planes, and all of a sudden there was an explosion in the tail end of the section, and it filled up with smoke. And, of course, being at that high altitude and the holes that were in the plane and everything else, the air cleared up real quick. So there I am, realized that I was wounded. I got on my throat mic, and I called it to the crew pilot, tail gunner crew, I'm hit. And I'm pushing on the button, the throat mic, and trying to report to them. I get no answer. As it happened, find out later on, this was all shot out, the whole communication system. So the only way they communicated up front, the flight engineer were hollering back into the plane, as loud as they could, giving orders and what to do. They chopped out the, this told me just later on, They got a hatchet and chopped the ball turret out and dropped that. Threw all the ammunition out. They were throwing ammunition out and everything else to lighten the plane up, you know.
Because you guys had lost 3 of the 4 engines, right?
Yeah. So this I wasn't aware of, but after our reunions and that, I was told about it. And another fellow had a video camera when we were doing it, and they all pitched in, and I had that document, which helped me write the book. They filled in the blank spaces that I, at that time, didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
My waist gunner, we came to a crossroad going down the road towards the farmhouse, and he's got his hands over his head with a German guard with a rifle on his back, you know. And I was on a two-wheel cart that they had gotten a picket fence and put it across the two-wheel cart, and that was my stretcher. So they're marching him down, marching me down to the place, and then we come to another place, and they took him one place, and they took me to the farmhouse.
Yeah, you guys crossed right past each other and didn't even know it, but I don't think our listeners want to skip right through how you got out of the plane and made it to the ground, because it took some heroic efforts to make that possible. We have to take a break, but when we come back, Frank Kravitz will explain those events of 11-2-44. His book, 11-2, is available on Amazon. I have a link to that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. It would make a great Christmas gift, because not only is his story incredible, the book is really well done. We'll find out how Frank got out of that crippled B-17 when Hometown Heroes continues after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening to the remarkable story of Frank Kravitz today. Thanks to the staff of the VA Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for allowing me to record this chat with Frank as he recovered there from some recent injuries. He survived a lot worse than that, as we're going to explore further now. We know this B-17 tail gunner was shot down on just his 6th mission, November 2nd, 1944. But we haven't heard how he safely exited a crippled bomber that had lost 3 of its 4 engines. And you were hit, Frank. That fire from a German fighter plane had left you pretty severely wounded. And you were pretty much incapacitated, weren't you?
Well, my radio operator and another fella both have me laying on the floor. And they put sulfa powder on my wound, bandaged it, and put a big compress on it. Did stop the bleeding, you know.
And this is your left thigh, and you still have shrapnel in that left thigh, right?
Over 100 pieces.
I bet you're fun to go through a metal detector with.
No, it's an interesting story, too. My wife and I took them to some of her relatives had moved to California, so we took a trip to California. So I took my wife and three kids on a plane ride to California. We get off at LAX airport, and I let the children go through, and my wife go through, then I go through. As soon as I passed, the thing, bells went off, and horns were blowing, and everything else, you know. And my family's waiting for us to greet them, you know. Two guys grabbed me by the arm. Would you step back and go through again? So I stepped back and I went through again. Now they really grabbed me and took me off to the side. You know, I says, what are you doing? What's wrong with me, you know? And my cousins out there, put them in jail. Put them, just, they're stupid, you know. So, we laugh about it all the time. Yeah. But they took me in a little room and they asked me to strip and everything else, you know. Yeah. I says, what are you looking for? I says, I don't have no pistols or guns or nothing, you know. You know, he says, well, you're ticking off the thing. I says, how about the shrapnel in my legs? So I says, I'll drop my legs here. I got over 100 pieces in my legs. So they put the thing up there, and that's what it was. Uh-huh. Yeah, but now things are more sophisticated.
I'm sure your kids remembered that, too.
It's that time when I come to them with their dad.
Well, you dealt with much worse interrogations than that, I know, too, and I want people to understand what the situation is here. So you're on this airplane that is barely making it, that is not going to make it, and there's a real chance you aren't going to make it. You're wounded severely. You can't get yourself out of this plane, so you needed your fellow crew members to save your life, right?
After they dragged me through from the tail of the ship into the radio room, which was like a cabinet, you know, so that they could talk, and you didn't have the noise in here in the radio room, you know. So when I was on the floor, they looks at my wound and everything. He put sulfa powder on it, made compresses on it, you know, wrapped it real tight and gave me morphine and other sedatives. It was in the first aid kit, you know. And I was awake.
What was going through your head?
I had no idea. I don't. The thing is, as things were happening, and I'd say to myself, all I was doing there was trying to remember what's going on, unconsciously, yeah. You know. Observing everything that's going on, and that's why I have such a vivid picture of it. What's ahead, I don't know. It's just happening there. You're looking at it, and I remember it, you know.
So you couldn't walk, you couldn't bail out yourself, and the captain's given the order to bail out, right?
Yeah, the captain gave the order to bail out, and they took care of me first, and they got me over to the door, put the chute on me, popped the chute in the floor, and put it in my arms and tossed me out. I just didn't take long for the chute to open up, you know. Quite a jolt, by the way.
Well, yeah, so they actually pulled the ripcord before they pushed you out of the plane. So then it's opening immediately when you pop out of that plane.
Yeah. It was happening. I wasn't thinking about it. I guess my mind was just recording it, that's all.
So you had a pretty long way down to the ground. Were you conscious? Were you looking around you? What did you see?
At first, I thought I was going up. Yeah, and honest to God, I said, geez, this thing's going up, you know. And then all of a sudden, the ground started coming up to me, meet me, you know. And then there were dwellings around the area, and there was farms and everything else. So I remember that, you know. And then after I landed, I know where it was, you know. And I have one member of my crew that went over later, many years later, and he documented where our plane went down. Then when we had reunions, I had another fellow brought his video camera, and they all talked around, and we have a video of that, you know.
While all this was going on, did the thought enter your mind that you might not wake up another day, that this might be it for you?
No. I didn't think about death then, you know. I just was observing what's happening at now. That was the only thing I was interested in.
And what happened when you hit the ground?
I tumbled like a jackrabbit. I tumbled down the hill. Yeah, a few steps like that, because it was on a little hill like this, and I just boom, 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 you know. I know their instructions were to hold your feet up, and it's like you got to, easier said than done, you know, especially if you're wounded, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think of that, you know.
Well, and I've talked to some POWs who tried to hide or avoid capture, and most of them, you know, maybe they lasted a few hours, but they were eventually captured, and in your case, there wasn't much you could do because you couldn't move unless you dragged yourself with your arms, huh?
Yeah. I had no motion at all. I had to be on a stretcher or a bed somewhere, and that was it, you know.
Who found you? What did they say to you?
There were two German members of the Wehrmacht, like sad sacks, you know, not very neatly dressed or, you know, they were doing a job, that's all they were doing.
But there was another situation here where somebody saved your life because there were some civilians you'd been bombing that wanted to take your life, right?
The civilians were coming in a distance and they came close enough that I saw they had pitchforks and that in your hands and that, and the two Germans fired a couple rounds and they went back to where that house was that they eventually took me anyway, you know, took me to the farmhouse where the Hitler Youth took them, you know.
So that night you spent the night in a cow barn, unable to move, guarded by two members of the Hitler Jugend. I can't imagine what that felt like. And even after they got you to a hospital, you don't know how much they really want to take care of you. You don't speak their language. And there was a real fear that you might lose your leg.
Well, I said when I lay on the table and the flying nun that was just attending to the doctor, at the thing in the table wasn't more than 3 feet wide and about belly high, you know, where I was laying on, maybe chest high or right here. And the nun was looking straight at my face, you know. I don't know what the procedure was, but I know they put a container on my nose and told me to count. And I remember counting to about 100.
You wanted to know if they were going to cut off your leg, so you motioned?
The nun was beside me, and I made motions with my hand if they were going to amputate. And the nun says, nine. I already knew because my mother spoke German, so different words that I didn't know from that, you know. And I just had no thoughts more, but somebody's taking care of me. Do with me what thou wilt.
But when you came to after that operation, what was the first thing you did?
Well, I took my hand, started my hip, and went down the side and see if I still had a leg. Because I thought the Germans were historically, amputations were the easiest way out. So that's what had happened. And I went down my leg and it's like that. And they patched me up the best they could. And I don't know what the drugs they used on me or anything else. But they comforted me enough that a couple of days later I was taken on a train to the interrogation center in Dulag Luft were for down flyers.
So they didn't amputate, they took care of you. So here you have a situation. A, the civilians basically have a lynch mob and they want to take you out, and these German guards shoot their gun in the air to save your life. And then these medical professionals save your leg and get you fixed up. Looking back now, how does that make you feel to know that these people on the other side of the war, your enemies, took such good care of you?
Well, I think later finding out that because we had been taking care of down German flyers, bringing them to the United States and taking care of them, and they know what they got in the United States, German flyers here in the country, what good service they were getting, you know. I think that reflected back to us, where we didn't get treated as miserable. What do you call it, camaraderie between flyers? Yeah, you know. So that's what I prevailed.
So you spent a lot of time just healing up, but then you still had to spend time in a couple different prisoner of war camps. I know you were about 175 pounds or so when you went into the service.
When I signed up, I weighed 175 pounds. I had to be 170 to get into the Air Force. So I went back to my football coach, went down to the football field, and I worked out with a football team, you know, during the summer with him. But my stepmother's angry at me because I'm not eating. I don't want to eat. I just went on a diet, and I was determined I'm going to get in the Air Force, and I'm going to lose this weight, and I'm going to get in. So I did, you know.
A little more than a year after you were losing weight to get in the service, you were starting to lose weight, not by choice, because as a prisoner, you just didn't have much food. What was the worst of that? What was the hardest thing to deal with that element of your captivity?
Well, example to that is, I'll put it this way. One day, I was there. They put me in an upper bunk because I'm not going to be ambulatory for a long time. They brought another down flyer in a bed next to me. We had our pleasantries, and he was in bad shape and everything else, you know. But he brought our food out. As meager as it was, you know, I ate it, you know, and he's screaming, "I can't eat this crap," you know. I says, "Well, what are you going to do with it, you know?" He says, "You want it?" I says, "Yeah, I'll take it." So he passed it over to me, and I ate it, you know. A couple of days of that, no more food came over. he needed it. Yeah, but that was a part of us. I said, give me all you got, you know. Yeah. But then, when I went to after my hospital visit, they had, like I said, the food parcels that they confiscated, and they used them for themselves and for us.
So the Red Cross would send parcels, but it didn't all make it to you guys, the prisoners.
They did, meagerly. In fact, every parcel that they brought to the hospital, they punctured it. So if you had meat and beans in there, boom, you had to eat it within a couple of days, you know. So the idea was to hoard those things that you're going to last longer, sugar, coffee, chocolate bars. You take, start eating small pieces of it, you know.
And you would make use of the packaging some of that stuff came in, too. I know in your book you have a picture of a replica of the stove that you improvised. Tell us about that stove.
The history of the stove is the British were longer in the war than we were. They were real troopers, and they're the ones that designed various different designs of, call them Krieger stove, K-R-E-I-G for Kriegerfunken, you know. So we called them Krieger stoves. So when I was in marching on the road and had this other thing, I just stuck in my mind because other people had them, you know. Years later, when I came home, you know, I said, I'm going to make one of them things. And I did.
So tell us what it's made out of, because I don't think many people would think to make a stove out of the elements that you had to work with.
Well, first of all, with a stove, you have to have a furnace with a something that's going to hold the flame of whatever you're going to use to boil, if it's water, you know. And so you had a can underneath that held the chips of wood that you scrounged around from somewhere. Some guys went out to work and they brought in trees in their pockets and that. And there was some kind of a supply that you could have in their barracks that somebody always had. And they made these stoves, and with the forced air that they had, it didn't take as much time, little blast furnace, you know, and a small quantity, you know, to make a cup of tea. And once they got this thing going, get your can ready, put it on here, and then next guy's on there, next guy's on there, just stuff like that. So that's how that worked.
So you made it out of Klim cans that had come in the Red Cross parcels.
Klim cans, and then there were other cans. Flattened them out with a wooden mallet and made the wheel, or the lids with our coffee came in. They put two lids together to make the wheel.
Did you ever eat the infamous bread made out of mostly sawdust?
Did I? I sure did. I sure did. In fact, if you give me your address, I'm going to send you, it was in our POW magazine, a copy of the ingredients.
The recipe, let me guess, there's a lot of tree flour, right?
Yeah. In fact, they use the outer bark, it seems like.
You didn't mind because it was something to eat?
Well, absolutely.
Did you ever think of escaping?
No, I don't think I ever did. With that many people, you know, guns are there, they're going to open fire on you. But first of all, there was a 10-foot warning wire inside and a 20-foot wire outside and barbed wire in that empty space. Now, many of the guys lost their life by trying to get through that maze because they got fired on right away anyway. And then the tunnel bit and everything else. I didn't see any of that kind of stuff, but it's historically, they did dig tunnels.
And how much did you weigh when you were liberated?
118 pounds.
So all these months, you're wasting away. You don't have enough to eat. You don't know when the war is going to be over or that your side's going to win. What gave you hope? Where did that come from? How did you believe that there was still a life out there for you?
I believed in the good Lord would take care of me. It's all whatever becomes of me. You never thought you were going to die, or for that matter. You know, you're living, so you live. And who knows when you're going to die anyway, you know.
And all this time, your family had no idea what had happened to you?
No.
In Frank's book, 11-2, there's a photo of the telegram his family received reporting him missing in action. Also a newspaper clipping from when it was learned he was in a prisoner of war camp. I got the link to his book posted on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear the rest of Frank Kravitz's story when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years.
my favorite place to eat, period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 90-year-old ex-prisoner of war, Frank Kravitz of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was only in Pittsburgh for less than 24 hours, and Frank was actually in the hospital recovering from an injury. But his wife, Ann, thought he should do the interview anyway. I'm so glad we did. And Ann told me a story that might turn your stomach a little bit. It is certainly unique, though, and worth talking about. Your wife told me about a really unorthodox way the doctors decided to fight infection in your wounds to help save your leg. What was that all about?
Well, when I was first taken to the hospital, they put the maggots on my... What was the question again?
So your wound was infected, and they used maggots.
Right. That's the first thing they did. After maggots were in there, I'm under sheet tent, like, you know, so it wouldn't be touching the operation. Then all of a sudden I could lay on my back with a pillow maybe that big, and, you know, I'm looking up, and every other day or so that the British orderlies, the doctors were looking at it, and then when they finally come rinse it off because it turned white, now they start cleaning the wound. And then they started the operation of taking skin from my rear end, and we put them in some kind of fluid and that, and put it on my wound, and it coagulated on my wound, and that's the skin grafting I had.
This is really serious stuff that you had to deal with, and I guess there's another instance. We talked about your crewmate saving your life, and the German saved your life. I guess the maggot saved at least your leg?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's a funny thing about that, too. When I come home, I started to maybe up at the VFW or wherever I was. I joined the VFW right away, yeah. And everybody's talking. And one of my other friends was a POW, you know, and they hear us talking about having these maggots taking care of our wounds, you know. And he says, oh, you guys are full of crap. They don't use maggots, you know, on things. And actually made a joke out of it and everything else. I resented the fact, you know. You know, I resented it. I said, okay, I'll shut my mouth. You're going to be that way. Nobody's going to believe me anyway, so, right? You know, so I shut my mouth. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell anybody about how they took care of it, you know. Many years later, and I can't say it was 10, 15, or 20 like that, there was an article in the Pittsburgh Press, a big spreadsheet, not talking about military. A doctor up in one of the towns north of me is using maggots for certain wounds in that, you know. I cut that sucker out so fast, put it in my pocket, you know, and anybody ever mentioned it again, I tell you, here. Yeah, you know, I tell you, my pro-wife probably didn't believe it. So, you know, so it's so far-fetched. Yeah. Nobody knows about that, you know.
Well, and it's not one you want to tell at a dinner party, I suppose. Might turn a few stomachs.
No, but... Those are just the tidbits that are true, that's all I know how to say. That's true.
Well, and obviously the fact that we're sitting here talking, and the fact that that you have three children and five grandchildren, none of them would have been here if you didn't make it through all this, if you didn't survive, if you weren't eventually liberated. And sounds like there's a pretty good story about the day of your liberation and some things that you saw that you'll never forget. This was in Moosburg, Germany?
Well, I arrived at this camp from our long march from Nuremberg to Moosburg, Germany.
How long was the march?
90 kilometers. It took us about 15 or 16 days to walk, you know.
With anything to eat or no?
Yeah, we had whatever we could scrounge, you know. People, there were Germans that had potatoes, and if somebody had something, could barter with them. and whatever we saved to go on the trip that we had in the sack to sustain us, you know.
You're in Nuremberg, and you march 16 days to Moosburg.
And when we got inside of Moosburg, it was already crowded from other camps being vacated, and the things, us men coming in, the prisoners coming into the same compound. So it ended up, historically, it says that they were over 100,000 all nationality prisoners of war, Germans, French, whatever, at this camp. And on April 29th, our senior officer in charge of the United States Army that were opposing the Germans that were protecting their prisoners, and they were about to release them, they sent a group to the German groups there, the white flags and that. They come back, and the Germans refused. They're going to attack the camp. So, and we didn't know this, but that's the historically what it was, you know. So it was about 9 o'clock in the morning on April 29th that the fire started. Our tanks start coming down over the hill. We saw them, and then all kind of vehicles, you know, and so much fire, you know, was going. And I guess the confrontation lasted maybe about an hour and a half. And our people inside says, lay on the ground, get under the barracks, get it done, because the fire's going on. And just hoping they're shooting at our troops, and we're getting the residuals of it, you know, from in the air, you know. Some fellas were hurt, you know, from it, you know. Shortly before noon, we saw the flag go up over Moosburg.
When you say a flag, this is somewhere where there had been a swastika flying, but the new flag was?
American flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then all the shouting and everything was going on, you know, and it wasn't shortly after that that Patton, our troops came up to the gate, and then Patton came, followed in right away and rode up on his big white tank, you know, not white tank, but he looked like God anyway.
White gloves and pearl pistols, I'm sure.
Mayhem, you know, tears, you know, kissing ground and everything, hugging and everything else. And said we're going home, everything we could think about. And it didn't take long, though.
Just imagining or seeing in your mind's eye that American flag going up and Patton's forces coming through the gate brings all those emotions back for you, doesn't it?
Yes.
Another thing I saw in your book is your POW mugshot that the Germans had. How did you come to obtain that?
We had men of confidence in the camp, okay? And they were the ones that told us that they went into the main office for the camp. And as anybody wants their record, and they blow, you know, on a bullhorn they got off one of the soldiers. Anybody wants to get their record, go in and get it. Go in and get it. So I went in and got my record.
And when you look at that picture now, what comes to mind for you? The life that you've had all these years since then and everything you've been able to enjoy, what comes to mind when you look at that picture?
How the good Lord took care of me, brought me back home.
Was that one of those memorable moments for you too, getting back to America?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, once we got liberated from camp, it became a little bit hectic too, because May the 7th, there was a Luftwaffe airfield there right outside the camp, and they were bringing American planes in, and they were flying us back to Reims, France. So while we're waiting our turn, now we got a lot of guys to take care of. They made duck boards there, got water out of the creeks and everything else, and took showers and everything else. And somehow they got some uniform supplies or some clothes, whatever could get on, you know. And then we waited out, and they had a truck out there with donuts and coffee and all that kind of stuff. When it came your time to fly, you just held your pants up like this and whatever shirt you had on, got on the plane and went to France, which was a short ride. They're not that far, you know. They took us to a place that was reserved for us POWs, Camp Lucky Strike, and they debriefed us on our conditions that we're going to feed you. We're going to feed you with very small portions, and we don't want you to drink this much water. You don't need to get so much. They weren't going to put buckets out there and let us drown ourselves, you know. So that was the story, but they really brought us back properly, I guess you could call it, you know.
Yeah.
So little at a time, you know.
So you had joined the service on November 2nd. 1943. You were shot down November 2nd, 1944. What happened on November 2nd, 1945?
Oh, discharge, yeah. Yeah, I was discharged then.
Did you want to fatten yourself up a little bit before you saw Ann again so you were sure she'd recognize you?
I was a skinny rail. It didn't make any difference to me then. You know, and my mother's my stepmother was trying to feed me. She said, go ahead eat. I said, I can't eat. I can't. You didn't understand how my stomach was, you know. So I just didn't eat, you know. He says, well, you're never going to get better. I said, oh, leave me alone. Then it's like rebelling at people because they don't understand.
And you said before you left, you had asked Ann if her parents would let her marry you, and she said absolutely not. How long did you wait before you asked again?
I was discharged in November, and I gave her a ring for Christmas.
And this time the answer was absolutely yes?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. We waited 9 months, and then we got married in September of the next year.
And you've been married ever since, 67 years. What's your secret?
Liking one another. If you're madly in love, and it might, you know, but if you like one another and give each other space, you don't have any problem, you know. Because I adored her, you know, sure I loved her, you know. And the fact that she did anything for me that I wanted, you know, but liking one another and being compatible, I think. She went on bowling parties with her, go. You know, I went golf trips, I go. There was no, you're going out again, you're going, you know, none of that.
Right.
None of that ever existed. We both gave ourselves space, and then we had our space together.
Well, that's good advice for the rest of us. I know that you've experienced plenty more, and you've been involved in the American ex-prisoners of war and the national leadership. You were at the National World War II Memorial when it was dedicated in 2004. You've seen and done a lot in your 90 years. When you look back on everything you've been through, what are you most thankful for, or what are you most proud of?
Well, first of all, I owe everything up to my dear wife, you know, and together with the three children we had, I just am so thankful that I had that freedom and not worry, that I could make decisions without making problems for everybody and myself. You know, I said, if I put your pillow, the head down on a pillow, and I go to sleep, forget everything, just, you know, petty things, and I, you have to screen to take you know, oh, I got this, owe this money. That's not important, or so many other things is important than petty things. I call them petty things, you know. And I think my children learned from me, not that I was firm about it, you know, but I think by example I learned. There's only so much you need anyway, you know. Oh, you'll get that later. Don't worry about it. It's not, you know, do this here. And the less you demand, the easier it is.
And that perspective, I'm guessing, came from your time as a prisoner of war, that you realized how little you really needed?
Yeah, I think so. There's things that you can experience in your life that are very traumatic, but there are more things that are happy. So you don't dwell on the sadness and everything else. There's solutions to all things like that, sadness, you know, and some good might even come out of them, you know. But don't dwell on it because you'll ruin yourself.
I know you believe that God had a plan for you, and speaking of, I forgot to ask you about one other thing you did in the prison camp that I know you've reenacted for your kids. Tell us what your POW ingenuity led you to craft out of a few pieces of string.
Being a Catholic and raised a Catholic in grade school and everything else, you know, and we learned to pray the rosary, and naturally we had our prayer books and rosaries, military rosaries with us, and when the Germans took them off of us, there was no secret. The other people did it too, so I followed suit and made a rosary and used them to sustain my faith. And my prayers were to make me healthy and return to my family, and I dedicated myself to that. You know, I told the dear Lord, if you let me get out of this predicament that I'm in, I'll never complain in my life. And I've done that.
Well, and you're proving it right now, because we're doing this interview in the VA hospital where they're treating you for a broken arm, and I haven't heard you complaining. Frank, I want to just thank you for serving our country. Thank you for writing your story, and I hope a lot of people will pick up your book, 11-2, and read about it. And I guess we should wrap up with the final 11-2, because we talked about November 2nd, 43, 44, and 45. But there's another more recent November 2nd that's important. Tell me what that is.
Writing the book. I says, I think I should write something about my family. Maybe 10 pages of my experiences, you know. My daughter Cheryl says, Dad, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing my memoirs. She says, what are you doing that for? Her and her sister was already talking about it. She says, that's not good enough. We're going to tell your story in the service, when you were in the service, too, not just about the family. I want everybody to know what you did. So with their encouragement, they met at my house every Monday night for over 2 years, and I had my drawers filled with everything that I had, paperwork and notes and letters from my friends that helped me, and I researched a lot of the places I was, and I researched this, and then they started putting in order and everything else and pumped me real good for questions, you know. So it all came out, and I think they did a good job. You know, if anybody hears part of the story, they'll realize what I'm trying to say. And if it helps one person to straighten their life out and lean towards the good Lord or something, or not worry about something, then it's possible.
Well, I know your story has touched a whole lot more than just one person today. And hopefully, if you enjoyed hearing from Frank, you'll look into his book, published on November 2nd, 2010, 11-2, One World War II Airman's Story of Capture, Survival, and Freedom. I have it linked on that Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for now. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again, as Frank Kravitz did so powerfully today, that freedom is not free.